Hey everybody, I'm Ashton Demery.
And I'm Nicole Demery.
And welcome to our Atheist Bible Study.
Where our tagline is an apology. So I hate doing these because I like to think of our podcast as being timeless and, you know, in the future, way down the line, when somebody picks up our podcast and starts going through these episodes, you know, they're not going to care that we took months in between episodes because they're all going to be there for them and they can just go to the next one. But Ashton is always thinking of the now and of you all, which we are clearly undeserving of, and we appreciate you all very much for sticking with our podcast. So we just want to say sorry and we love you.
Well, now that we're finally back, today we're talking about 1 Kings. So we'll give a little background on the books of Kings, 1 Kings and 2 Kings. I think I've mentioned this before, but in the original layout of the Old Testament, there were 4 kings. So 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 3 Kings, 4 Kings, which this would be 3 Kings. The way that the Protestants, Protestant Christians decided to lay it out and kind of reformed it at one point was they decided to rename 1 and 2 Kings to 1 and 2 Samuel, and the Catholics follow suit and change theirs too. So that's how that happened. This would have been normally 3 Kings. Now it's 1 Kings. And the names, I guess, just, you know, they do match a little bit more with what the stories are about, except that 2 Samuel, Samuel's kind of dead by that point anyways. But yeah, so this book, like all the books we've been talking about, follows along in the Deuteronomistic history that we talked about. And so ultimately the whole thing is understood to be potentially based on an original text that might have been written sometime in the 7th century BCE and ultimately was redacted, you know, several times to make up the books we have now. And the redaction is believed to go as far as into the exilic and post-exilic period. The exilic period, which started in 550 BCE when Israel was exiled due to Babylon basically destroying it. So I'd talk a little bit about Solomon and really just whether or not he's believed to be like a real person or not, which I don't know if we actually address this for David either. So we'll talk a little bit about both of them. So for Solomon, there is no clear extra biblical evidence that he existed, right? So all we really have is the Bible, and historians are somewhat split on whether or not they believe that he existed, which really comes down to, like, you know, just how much evidence you really need to believe a person exists or not. I think I live in the camp of if the only thing you have is the Bible, then you might as well just assume they didn't.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. And also with you talking about this, I know a lot of you are very, well, some of you are very excited for us to get to the New Testament. So I can't wait for us to have this discussion about Jesus.
Yes, I have, yeah, I have strong
I'm sure you've
about
already
this.
Started looking at it, but no, I'm with you. Like, if the Bible is the only source, I already have strong reservations about how much of the Bible itself is true. So if, like, you're telling me about a person and there's no other documentation of this person, like, probably it's a no for me.
Right.
I don't think they exist.
For me, you can just assume they didn't. But yeah. Historians kind of go either way on it, and so there's debate about that. Some of the things they go on to, though, as far as deciding whether they exist or not, is whether the claims of the book seem to hold up in terms of what's in terms of what they can find archaeologically and from other historical evidence.
Yeah, well, maybe it's more of that for me too, where it's like maybe they existed, but like I don't believe these stories are like to the extent.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, there's a whole other discussion we can have, too, is, like, what does it mean to exist if all the stories about you are untrue, right? I don't know. You could say somebody existed if every story about them pretty much is untrue.
Right.
But this, the period of time in which this story is understood to be about, generally agreed about 970 to 931 BCE, is Solomon's reign. The archaeological evidence that we have basically indicates that any Israelite culture that existed in that time period was small and uninfluential, right? So the claims of this book really claim that it's quite extravagant, like almost, you know, some like a mini empire, right? That Solomon is controlling, and he's relatively important to other kingdoms, right? They all know about him and he's a big deal. Egypt, he's on Egypt's map, you know what I mean? And there's not much evidence that that is true. It's clear from archaeological evidence we have that Canaanite culture continued without any real disruption through this period, right? There's no indication that they were really taken over by another culture. Like I said, nothing really indicates a magnificent empire there. So some of them, you know, argue that, okay, well, like maybe some of this is the spirit of this maybe is true or whatever, but mm-hmm. like this kingdom was much smaller in size, more like a small city state. And some believe as small as like a few hundred people living in Jerusalem. Mm. And that it's just sort of been largely exaggerated. Just overall, like as far as archaeological evidence goes, that the 10th century BCE is kind of just a dead zone for Palestine. To some extent, maybe that's expected because Babylon destroyed it all. But even so, a true empire that this like book seems to claim, you would think something would survive, right? Like Babylon goes and destroys it, you'd find remnants of ruins of these massive temples that they claim existed.
Yeah, and there's like a whole passage on like the amount of gold that they have too. So.
Yes, right. Yeah, quite influential according to this book. Mm-hmm. And so David as well, right? There's not really much to suggest David existed either. The closest thing we found is some inscriptions that archaeologists have found. Some believe that they say that they reference David by name, or like a kingdom of David or the rule of David, or something of that nature, but they're uncertain. They're not like universally agreed on what those inscriptions say. And other people believe that they don't say that at all. So there's, again, no real clear 100% that we know David existed. So yeah, with that, we can kind of get into these stories here.
Okay, cool. Before we get into the stories, I also just want to say something that's like wild about the Bible to me is that a lot of these names, you know, a lot of children are named after biblical figures. And now after reading these stories, some of them are like very questionable choices, like, you know, David for one of them. But yeah, it's just weird hearing names like David and John. And then we also have characters like in this chapter, like Adonijah, like yeah. Absalom. And it's just like this sort of weird mixing of names that are super common to you and the names that are just like completely foreign.
Yeah. And it's hard too, because like, you know, the name David, I feel a little attached to. It's my middle name. Oh, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's a terrible person to name someone after, but.
And pretty much all of them are, like, except for, well, no, I can't name specifics, but like, from what we've seen from all of the kings, is all the kings kind of start out at least somewhat good, like there's something good about them, but they all end up dying on some terrible note.
Yeah. And I mean, there's names in here that you could say are perfectly fine, but that's mostly based on the fact that they're not actually influential.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we don't know much about them. We don't, like, hear much about them. But if you spend enough time with any of these characters, right, they all turn a little dark. Right?
Yeah. So 1 Kings starts out with David being cold at night, and so his advisors think the best solution to this is to find a virgin for him to sleep with, because virgins are the warmest of people to have in your bed.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, also, like, I mean, if they're going to bring him, like, a new wife or whatever, I can't imagine. It's clear, like, everything we've read so far, that if you're not a virgin and you're, you know, not married, like, you're kind of considered of no value, so.
It's not a wife, though.
Huh?
He doesn't marry her.
Oh, that's true. I guess he technically doesn't. But
yeah.
Yeah, anyway, I mean, it seems like, you know, if they brought him any less than a virgin, that would be, like, you know, unsatisfactory for a king or whatever.
I suppose, but like they
according to this, you know, these books,
they really act like the cold is the issue, and I just don't know why you would go for a virgin for that case.
Yeah, and to your point, I think feel like they make this very, you know, the big point that he never slept with her.
No, they make a big, yeah. So there's like a whole line about that. It would be outrageous if he had slept with her, because he's so old and this is like a young version. So he, mm-hmm. you, of course, never touched her while she was in his bed.
Right. It's one of those things, though. You're protesting a little too much. You make mm-hmm. a big deal about telling me it's all about the fact that she's warm and that he just needs someone to cuddle. And then you very specifically tell me that He didn't sleep with her. Come on.
Oh, and also they didn't look for just like any virgin. They looked for a beautiful one because the beautiful ones are particularly warm.
Of course. Mm-hmm. It all makes sense.
Yeah. So after we get this like very abrupt passage about them finding a virgin for David to sleep with, not like that though, just to keep him warm at night.
Of course.
Then we have Adonijah, which is one of David's sons. He starts declaring himself king, basically. He starts like saying to everybody that he's going to be the next king.
Right. Again. Yeah.
And he has the support of like a pretty influential group. Like there are quite a few people that are behind him and backing him and supporting him.
Yeah, so he gets Job and Abiathar at a minimum. I think there were a couple others too, but those were the main like notable.
Yeah, characters. And there's definitely like a group of men who back him, like some soldiers and stuff. Anyways, so Nathan, who like I feel like we've kind of lost track a little bit of the holy men. So there's been like this whole time there's been this like succession of kings, and remember it got really confusing when there was Samuel and or I got really confused. Who is it? It was Samuel and
Eli?
No, it was another S name. That's why I kept mixing them up.
Oh, Samuel and Saul.
Samuel and Saul? Yeah. Okay.
Saul was the king, Samuel was the priest.
Yeah. Anyways, so we've been keeping track of like who is king and also like who is like the top priest, because that's also like a very like high position. So right now it's Nathan. So Nathan is like top bitch in the like priest, like holy world.
Right.
So Nathan catches wind of Adonijah declaring himself king. So he goes to Bathsheba, who is the woman that David rapes. Is that? I mean, he rapes a lot of women. But she's like the main one that we hear about.
She's the name we know.
Yeah, he's the one that he sees like bathing from his window or whatever. And she gives birth to his son, Solomon. And there's like this whole promise that Solomon is going to be king. So Nathan goes to Bathsheba to remind her that her son is supposed to be king. And she's like, yeah, like I know this. Why are you telling me this? And he tells her that, well, like Adonijah is starting to go around and tell people that he's going to be king. And there are some people who are starting to back him. So they both go to talk to David. So Bathsheba goes first and is sort of reminding David of his promise to Solomon. And then Nathan shows up shortly afterwards and is also talking about how like Adonijah is saying that he's going to be king, but really it should be Solomon because, you know, like, didn't we talk about this earlier that, right, like, Solomon was going to be king? So David re-swears to Bathsheba that Solomon will be king, and that's basically what ends up happening.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like, the, you know, the most anticlimactic, you know, rebellion we've had. Yeah. All the other ones actually resulted in wars, but this one, you know, David just goes, okay, well, I guess I'll just go declare Solomon to be king. And then he does. And then Adonijah just kind of backs off.
Yeah.
Even though Adonijah is the oldest son, right? He is technically next in line to be king. And so this is, again, that same theme we've had of the younger being kind of lifted up over the older.
Mm-hmm. So while David is alive, he kind of like ascends Solomon to be king. And Solomon swears that he won't harm a single, like, hair on Adonijah's head as long as he is, like, a good man.
Yeah, it actually talks about here when he crowns Solomon and Abiathar tells Adonijah about it. Adonijah is afraid because he thinks Solomon's going to kill him. And so he grabs on to the horns of the altar. And it seemed like kind of a strange thing to note, but what they're referencing here is the asylum laws that we talked about earlier and haven't really like come up in an actual story yet. But that's what they're doing is they're referencing that he's basically taking asylum at the altar because he thinks Solomon's going to try to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And this will come up again shortly.
Right. So Solomon is king, but David is still alive. So David is giving him some advice about how he should be king. And he basically just tells him like a list of people that he should go ahead and forgive and a list of people that really wronged them, so Solomon should kill.
I thought it was pretty funny that, so he tells him finally it's time for Job to get his, right? Because Job, we've been talking about for a while, he's just been getting away with everything.
Yeah.
Multiple murders. And then he tells him not to forgive Shimei, right? Remember how he high-roaded us before when Shimei starts, like, you know, spitting at him and throwing insults and all of his men are like, kill this motherfucker, right? Like,
yeah.
And then he just high-roads us like, you know, how could I say anything to Shimei? The Lord has told him to curse me. So, you know, how can I tell him otherwise? Right. And then, so we move on from that. And then Shimei comes back and apologizes because David becomes the king again.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, sure, Shimei, you know, pass the pass, basically, like, let's it go. And then all of a sudden now he's like, cool, well, you need to make sure that you murder Shimei. Like, it's like, what?
What happened to?
Yeah, like, all of a sudden now we got to have Solomon kill him.
Yeah. So after David gives these instructions, he passes away. And the new, like, hot phrase of 1 Kings is, then David slept with his ancestors. So now, like, every time a king dies, we hear this phrase over and over again, that they slept with their ancestors.
Yeah.
So Solomon is now, like, okay, he's been king, but now David is dead. So now he's kind of, like, reshuffling the people underneath him and figuring out who's loyal, I guess. So Adonijah goes to Bathsheba and complains that, you know, he should really be the one who is king, and he asks her for requests. And before he asks for the request, he says, like, do not refuse me. And I love her response because she just says, like, go on. Like, she doesn't, like, agree that, like, I'm going to absolutely, like, take your request. She's just like, okay, keep explaining. Like, give me more. And so he says that he wants Abishag, the Shunammite, as his wife.
Right.
And that's what he's asking
for. The young virgin.
Mm-hmm. So she agrees to, she's like, okay, this seems like pretty reasonable. I'll take this to Solomon. So she goes to Solomon and she kind of has like a similar like speech pattern when she's asking for this. She's like, I have a request and like, do not refuse me. And instead of like them following the pattern of him being like, okay, well, like go on. Solomon is like, okay, yeah, I won't refuse you anything. Like, you're my mother. I'll give you anything that you ask for. So, so he doesn't know what she's going to ask. And so then she tells him that, that Adonijah is asking for Abishag. And he's like, nope, fuck this guy.
Yeah, he just says no.
Yeah, he's like, oh yeah, mom, I won't refuse you anything. And then he hears the request and he's like, yeah, I'm going to kill him. Like, he knows what he's doing. I'm going to kill that man.
Yeah. And yeah, I looked into like what lights him off this way over what was her name?
Abishag,
right. What lights him off that way? And the best explanation I could find was that Abishag was like the kind of most important woman in David's life towards the end there because she was with him all the time. You know, she's the virgin that he wants to warm his bed always. So, you know, she might have like, you know, information or might be politically powerful to Adonijah if he were to marry her. So then Solomon suspects him trying to kind of weasel his way into the
throne. Like, it would give him more like legitimacy to be king or something.
Yeah. That's the theory at least.
Yeah. It will. And when you read the passage too, like, I don't know his exact words, but he definitely like expresses that to Bathsheba, his mother, that like, oh, like he thinks that he can like use this to like become king. Like he's trying to weasel his way in kind of thing.
Right. And I also,
so she's like, she's influential enough that if he were to let them marry, that it would give him more like stake, I guess.
I also think it's funny that like, why does Bathsheba do this? Like, why does she agree? She's nothing in it for her. It's not her son that's asking it of her. I think this is just what the Bible thinks women are. It's like, you just tell them, hey, do this, and then they just do it.
Yeah. I mean, I like, for me, it was like, I'll take the crumbs that are given to me when we're reading these stories kind of thing. But I liked that somebody thought to go to a woman to ask for something. Like, you know, he needs something. And so he's like, okay, like, who has power and sway over Solomon?
Yeah.
And he, like, I don't know. Again, this is literally, like, the bar is on the floor. But, like, he thinks, like, oh, like, I'll go to his mother, like, a woman. Mm-hmm. Like, that, you know.
Well, certainly he can't respect his wife, so.
Yeah. I don't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess I was into this story just that little bit more because Bathsheba has some agency, it feels like, some sway over how events turn out, even though Solomon says he will give her anything, he doesn't.
Yep. Yeah.
So Solomon kills Adonijah. He also decides to kill a couple of priests because of this, because they backed him, because they backed Adonijah.
Yeah, so he banishes Abiathar, right? He doesn't kill him, but he mm-hmm. banishes him, thus fulfilling the word of God concerning Eli, is what it says. So it feels a little bit like the, you know, the redactors are cleaning house on old prophecies that didn't get closed out.
Yeah.
And he also sends Benaiah to kill Job at the altar where he's fled. So that's where it comes up again. He's at the altar, but he kills Job because Job is an actual murderer, right? Like, so that, you know, the altar doesn't provide solace for true murderers who do it in, you know, like first degree murder, right? Mm-hmm. And then he eventually, when he puts Shimei on house arrest and then tells him basically, you know, you're fine and unless you leave, then you're going to die. And so finally Shimei's slaves flee. So Shimei leaves to go get his slaves and Solomon has him killed. And there's a quote, you know, about all the evil that Shimei has done, which is the evil amounts to saying mean things to David. That's the extent of his evil.
Yeah. Okay. So the next, Solomon ends up marrying a daughter from the king of Egypt, which she doesn't get a name, but she kind of gets mentioned over and over again. Mm-hmm. She seems pretty important to Solomon.
Yeah, I mean, she's the daughter of...
It's like a big political tie, is what it is. Okay, and then we get this whole thing about David goes to pray. He, like, offers, you know, offerings to the Lord or whatever. And then God tells him that he can ask for anything that his heart desires. And Solomon prays for wisdom, which is very pleasing to God. He loves that Solomon has asked for wisdom instead of asking for a long life or riches or, you know,
the conquering standard
his enemies. Yeah, the things that kings normally ask for. And so he's like, you know what? Like, I'm going to give you wisdom and I'm also going to give you all of these things that you could have asked for.
Yeah.
And then didn't. Which, like, as a kid, this was like kind of one of the cooler Bible stories, in my opinion.
I don't even think we talked about it.
Oh, okay. I mean, I definitely went over the story of Solomon asking for wisdom and said, because to me, it was like the, okay, so when a genie grants you three wishes. I was just going to say,
it's like asking for more wishes, yeah.
No, I wasn't going to say it's like asking for wishes. It's like when a genie asks you for three wishes, people are always going to ask for things like, you know, a certain amount of money and the genie is always going to try to like twist it, right? Yeah. So you ask for these things and the genie is, there's like a book series that's like this, Children of the Lamp or something like that. So like, you know, you ask for a certain amount of money and then you don't specify in which currency. So then like the genie gives you
the money. Yeah, a million yen, right?
Yeah, or like the lowest amount, yeah, that it's worth. And they're, like, always doing these things. Like, you're asking for these selfish things, so then the genie, like, twists the wish to be something that you actually, like, don't want. But if you ask for something that's, like, stimulating, I guess, for the genie, then they'll, you know, honor the gift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what God is in the situation. Like, you know, he didn't ask for, like, a physical thing. He asked to know the difference between right and wrong. And mm-hmm. so God was just like, oh, my God, like, here is a man who...
Okay. Yeah, to me, as I was thinking of more, it's like, instead of asking for the things, he's asking for the key to give him anything he wants, in theory, right?
Like, yeah, and so, which, yeah, I found respectable.
Yeah.
But I will say, and like, you know, we don't have to get into this too much, but what he is essentially asking for is to know the difference between, like, what is good and what is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like something in the Bible that, you know, only God knows what's good and bad. And Therefore only men or his holy people know what's good and bad. And So like, I just, you know, that's always something to be thinking about, is like, who is deciding what is good and who is deciding what is bad? Because good and bad are both subjective things.
Yeah.
And they're not like absolutes.
Right. Right. Yeah. Speaking of which, There is like a note there that almost is imperceptible too, where it says kind of like he basically says that Solomon like did everything right except that he makes sacrifices at the high places, and it's almost imperceptible, like it kind of blends with the passage. You're not really like, it's not really obvious that like they're trying to tell you that he actually did something wrong, but basically it's prohibited that you sacrifice at these high places, which are kind of like, you know, places where a lot of paganry goes on. So all the sacrifices are supposed to be made at the temple, right? Even though they don't have like a central, he hasn't built the actual temple yet, they still have the tent of meeting and everything. All the sacrifices should be made at that central location.
Yeah. So after we get this whole explanation about Solomon being gifted with wisdom, and also now that comes with wealth and, you know, success over his enemies and all of these wonderful things, I was kind of expecting more stories about how wise Solomon is, but Solomon has like very few stories compared to David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So up next we have like the most, what I think is probably the most famous story of Solomon.
Yep.
And after that is over, there's not really much left to Solomon's reign.
Yep.
Story wise. So after Solomon gets blessed with wisdom, these two prostitutes, which in my upbringing, they were not prostitutes. They were just two women. So
they're unmarried. It's the same thing.
I just thought they just like happened to be two women living in the same house.
Yeah.
But anyway, so these two prostitutes come before Solomon, and they have this problem because there is a baby, and one of the women is claiming that. So the story is that they both gave birth on the same exact night, and in the middle of the night, one of the women rolled over onto her child and smothered them. So they died. She wakes up to realize that her child is dead. So she goes to the other woman who is sleeping with her baby, and she switches them out. So she now has the alive baby, and then she gives the dead baby to the other woman. And so the women come to Solomon, and the woman who has no child is saying, like, this is what happened. Like, her baby died in the middle of the night because she rolled over on top of them, and then she switched them out. Like, she has my baby.
Right.
And the other woman is denying this, saying, like, no, that lady's, she woke up with her dead baby, that she did that, and this is actually my baby. And so it's basically, you know, her word against the other person's word, her word.
Yeah.
So Solomon tells his servants to bring him his sword, and he says, okay, like, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to cut the baby in half, and then you each get a half of the baby. And so one of the women is like, okay, that sounds fair to me that we would each get half of a baby because I have so many uses for half of a baby.
Yeah.
And then the other woman is like, oh my gosh, no, like just let her keep the child. Like, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, Solomon recognizes that the woman who cares the most about the baby surviving is the true mother. And so he lets her keep the baby, which, so many things about the story. growing up, I will say, though, this really was like, he's wise. Like, this guy really knew how to solve problems.
Yeah. I'm just picturing, like, one of the, like, the super hot videos, and everybody's like, oh.
Yeah. But in actuality, like, you know, even if it turns out that that woman who, like, that woman didn't switch the babies and some, like, if she's willing to keep the baby alive, like, yeah, like, clearly she's going to make the better mother.
Yes.
But also, the big, like, plot hole in this is just, like, who would be okay with getting half of a baby?
No, anybody who thinks that this story, this shows, you know, that Solomon is super wise, they are a moron.
Because they're not thinking about the women. Like, no woman is going to be like...
This is what I would refer to as, like, riddle wisdom or poetic wisdom, right? Like, it has that kind of feel of, like, wisdom when it's in the form of, like, a riddle or a poem, right? Like,
well, no, because here's the thing.
Little fantasy world.
This is what bothers me about it. It's like, yeah, this could work if, like, there were actually, like, evil people out there who were okay with, like, getting half a baby. But, like, any just regular person off the street, nobody is going to be okay with that. Like, everybody's going to be like, like, no, you don't need to split the baby literally in half to solve this problem. Like, I don't get anything from that. Neither of us get anything from that. And I don't want to witness you sheath a baby in half.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Like, it works as the solution to a riddle. Like, you're like, oh, like, how do you solve this problem? It's like, well, I'll, like, offer to cut one of them in half and then see who tries to stop me, right? But in the real world, you know, in any time period, everyone's gonna be like, yeah, don't cut the baby in half. It doesn't do me any good.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a riddle. It doesn't really work if you actually believe these stories to be real stories.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, it reminds me of, like, you've heard this story a million times because it's never stopped bothering me, but I got this brain teaser problem in an elementary school class where they were like, you know, how do you cut a pizza into 8 slices, but you can only do 3 cuts? I was basically stumped. And I was like, I just told them, like, yeah, it's not possible. Right. And then they were like, oh, well, it is possible. You just fold the pizza in half. It's like, okay, but the pizza's ruined.
Ashton isn't a big fan of calzones.
You ruin the pizza when you do that, so it doesn't make any sense. In the same way that, like, it ruins the child if you cut it in half, and any reasonable person recognizes that, so no reasonable person, you know, accepts that as a solution. So another thing I'll talk about here is that this isn't, like, a unique folk tale. It's a folk tale that, you know, they're telling, and, like, people probably recognize the, you know, even the first time it was written into First Kings, but it's not unique. It exists in other cultures. There's almost identical ones. Mm-hmm. And there's this entire study of folk tales. You know, you can get a degree in folk tales, basically. And there's an index for all the different types of folk tales called the Arne Thompson's Index. So this even has, like, a classification within that index. It's literally got, like, a type number for this type
Fun fact about me, I studied to be a teacher in college. I took a storytelling class. And, yeah. This is, like, a real thing. Like, there's all of these, like, tropes that are very common in storytelling. Yep. And you can, like, once you start to see them, you kind of start to, like, recognize them everywhere. Yeah. Anyways, I love this.
So it has
Keep
a type
going.
Number.
Yeah.
And so Indian literature, like, Indian stories and religious tales and folk tales have several very similar stories. But, like, one of the most similar ones, there is a nature spirit who takes the shape of a woman and steals a baby. And basically this problem is taken to a sage, and that sage is actually a different incarnation of Buddha. So that sage announces a tug of war with the baby, and the winner takes the baby. And so we saw this in, we were real big fans for a while of the shows, the Sabrina show that they had on, I think it was Netflix.
And the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Yeah, they actually used this version of the story in an episode there. But it's a tug of war, and the winner, whoever gets the baby beyond the line, wins the baby. And then so whoever lets go really is the actual mother, because she doesn't want to hurt her baby.
Yeah.
And so, like, the common thread in all of these stories, there's Chinese ones as well, according to William Hansen, is that there's like a wise judge who is announcing an absurd procedure, which is reasonable, but in a perverse way. And the procedure is actually a concealed emotional test. And there's a whole lot of these out there.
Yeah.
I also thought the cause of death was really interesting here. And I wondered if it's actually a thing that women roll over and suffocate their babies.
Yeah.
And so I did like a whole bunch of research on that because I was interested in it. And this is like a thing that's actually really mothers are really afraid of.
Yeah.
I don't know if your sisters have talked about this at all. So there's like this thing called SIDS, which is like sudden infant death syndrome, where they just die in their sleep suddenly. And allegedly it's, you know, you're really risking that if you sleep with your baby. And so you're told not to.
Yeah.
And so the American Academy of Pediatrics warns you not to do it. And like this goes so far that there were, you know, there's like signs that have been up in some states that they're part of like these ad campaigns, and they compare their mothers to murderers. There's like, you know, pictures of a mother with like a butcher knife basically about to chop her baby. And it's like basically saying like, this is what you're doing if you decide to sleep with your baby.
Mm.
When I researched it though, like there's an NPR study on this that finds it's like actually not really that likely that if you sleep with your baby, you're going to kill your baby.
Yeah.
It's like one in like 16,400 for what's considered a low risk baby, which is a normal baby.
Yeah.
Assuming the mom is not drunk or doesn't smoke. Right. So
yeah,
it's really actually quite rare. It's slightly more likely than if you let the baby sleep in the crib. And it's obviously like there's a lot of other factors. Like you have the fluffiest, cushiest bed with a fluffy comforter. That's a little bit worse because there's more likelihood of suffocation.
Mm-hmm.
But rolling over on top of your baby usually isn't the cause unless you're drunk.
Yeah. And that makes sense. Like evolutionary, you know what I mean? Because like I'm assuming in our past, in our like more primitive stages, we weren't putting our babies into like cribs. We were likely sleeping with them. So I'm sure we developed
a cave.
Yeah. So I'm sure like if we're like impaired in some way, like you're saying, like if we've been drinking, then it's more likely. And also I have memories of, I know that I definitely slept in my parents' bed as a baby, or at least one of my siblings did. Cause I know my mom has told stories about her shoving my dad off of us as like children, like get off of the baby. Because we were sleeping in the red. And also, back to my college years in my child development classes. Yeah, that's like a thing too, where the kind of advice beyond not sleeping with your kid, even though like you were saying, it's not as that common. Mm-hmm. You also aren't supposed to put a lot of things in the crib with the baby, like blankets and stuffed animals and stuff like that.
And that is kind of real. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but you know. It's a scale, you know, it's not you sleep in the bed with your baby and like there's a 90% chance they're going to die, you know, but a premature baby is like much more likely and stuff like that. There's a bunch of other factors, but I think it's interesting because, you know, I think most mothers live in like constant anxiety when they have a baby that's young, especially if it's like their first child. And there's just like so many things that we're constantly painting mothers as just completely like ignorance, not the word, but negligent, like
mm-hmm. like owning a cat while having a baby.
There was like a case in Texas where they tried to try a mom for like murder for you know, her baby dying mm-hmm. at sleep, and like just stuff like this. And like those ad campaigns just seem like, you know, absurd when you really think about it. And just like one more thing for moms to feel like anxious about and feel like they're just doing a terrible job because they don't want to deal with their kids screaming all night, because like kids, you know, babies tend to like to, like, it's just easier usually to put them in the bed. That's why moms do it.
Yeah. Do you think it's obvious to our listeners from this conversation that we don't have kids and are not planning on having kids?
I mean, I feel like we might have addressed it already, that we definitely don't, you know, have kids. Anyways, after that long, you know, aside, I hope it was interesting to the listeners. If not, great. So I guess let's get back into some of these stories here.
Okay. So it takes a while before there's more stories, but so then we get Solomon's administrative officers, which is just a listing of the names and positions of his officers. And then there's the magnificence of Solomon's rule, which is just going over how wonderful and how happy everyone is under Solomon's rule, how much wealth he has, just how well they're doing in general.
Yep. and this is where I talked about, like, you know, a lot of, not all, but a lot of scholars believe this to be, you know, heavily exaggerated.
Yeah. There's the fame of Solomon's wisdom. Talks about how basically far and wide everyone knows about how wonderful Solomon is, especially out of this whole two prostitute scenario where he comes up with the genius idea of cutting the baby in half. Then we have preparations and materials for the temple. So we get a direct contradiction, one that I noticed this time, and we didn't have to have Ashton point out. So they say that, so Solomon says that David couldn't build the temple for the Lord because they were constantly under attack. And so while David was ruling, since he was always having to deal with all of these enemies, there was no way that they could build the Lord a temple. And even though it has been like a few months since we've talked about David, I remember distinctly that David did try to build a temple to the Lord. And the Lord told him, like, not to do that. That was totally unnecessary. That was, like, heathenistic. Like, he didn't need a temple.
Yep.
That was for, like, other fake gods.
Yeah.
But now, under Solomon, suddenly, like, this is okay. And the Lord, like, would love a temple. And so Solomon starts putting this all together. And so then the next couple passages are just about Solomon building the temple, furnishing the temple, how long it takes to build it, seven years.
Just how big it is and everything.
Mm-hmm. Some, like, more, like, really exact descriptions of, like, the placement of things and what actually went into it. It also goes into Solomon building a palace for himself. And not just for himself, but he also built, like, a big extravagant home for the Pharaoh's daughter. His wife. There's Hiram, the bronze worker, who fills all of these places with his bronze work. And then once the temple is finally built, we get the story of how the ark is brought in. Solomon gives a speech to all the people about how God has blessed all of them. He gives a prayer of dedication about how wonderful God is. He blesses everybody there. And then there's, like, a little ceremony.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've seen similar passages in, like, Exodus and stuff. The only thing I thought to really look into there was kind of the size and scale of it. It says it's 30 cubits high, which turns out to be something like 40-ish to 50 feet in height. So pretty big. You know, it's not on the scale of, like, the pyramids or something, but seems hard to miss if something that size was built.
Yep, so then we get God appearing to Solomon, giving him the whole spiel about how he worships him and sticks with him, then he will, like, bless him forever for all these years, but if he turns against him, then that's a problem.
Yep.
So there's that, and then there's a section called Other Acts of Solomon, and it's basically just an explanation of Solomon using forced labor to accomplish all of these, you know, quote-unquote wonderful things of his kingdom. Then there's Solomon's commercial activity, which is a description of him building some ships. There's the visit of the Queen of Sheba, which sounded a lot more interesting than it actually was. Basically, it's just the Queen of Sheba has heard about how wise Solomon is, so she goes to visit him to, like, test him on his knowledge. And, you know, of course, he, like, surpasses everything that she thought of. Like, even the rumors couldn't, you know, truly capture how wonderful he really is. He gives her a bunch of gifts to go home with, so she leaves very happy. And then there's just a lot more talk about his wealth and how much gold he has. And his,
One thing I thought was interesting here was so the references to forced labor here, right? Again, most think that the description of the wealth that that this kingdom had at this time is vastly overrated, that, you know, it was likely very small in terms of number of people, right? Which means it's very unlikely they actually did have forced labor of non-Israelites, right? Like, it's probably not very likely that they did. They might have, you know, for a much smaller temple, put, you know, the people of, like, the Israelites or, you know, people living in Jerusalem to work, to do certain things. But it's not likely that they had outsiders working by forced labor to build massive temples based on what we know about the extent of this kingdom, which means that by, you know, the people who wrote this in saying that they do that, like, the forced labor is a mark of legitimacy to them, right? Like,
yeah,
that's like your mark of legitimacy as really powerful and influential kingdom, and that's a mark of what God has done for them, is that, right, if they have forced labor, like, they are really living in God's spirit, and doing as he wants, because they can afford to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I thought was really interesting about that. Also, there's like several mentions in these passages of, starting here, and we'll see it more later, but just like reminder that, like, yeah, if you walk in all my ways, yeah, just like your father did, right? Your father was perfect, right? Is what we get reminded of, which is like absurd. Of, like, everything we know about David, like,
he basically messed everything up and then still
gets
like remembered as this.
Like, he did everything right.
Yeah.
I walked in all of God's ways.
He never
made
a mistake.
Yeah.
So, like with every king, we see Solomon eventually lose the spirit of the Lord, and we start talking about the errors of Solomon. So, his biggest flaw was that he married way too many foreign women, and he was influenced by these women to start worshiping their gods.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, the Lord is not happy with this, and so he gives Solomon enemies.
Yeah. And did you recall how many wives he had?
No.
Oh. Well, it's said that Solomon had 700 princesses as wives.
How are there that many princesses?
Well, I guess by being his wife, that makes them a princess. Because I suppose there's only one queen, which...
Oh, I see. I get it now.
But yeah, so 700 princesses and 300 concubines. So 1,000 women, right? So, pretty quick math there, right? You could go almost 3 years and not see the same woman two nights in a row. Like, it's an absurd, it's not obviously real.
Yeah, it's like the Arabian Nights.
A ridiculous exaggeration. But, again, that's a mark of legitimacy, is to have that many women at your disposal.
Yeah. Okay, so God has said that he's going to make these enemies for Solomon because of him turning to other gods in his old age for his wives. There's this, like, uprising with Jeroboam. They kind of, like, breeze past it. So, so basically, they describe some kind of rebellion from Jeroboam that they tried to put out by killing him, but he escapes.
Right. So, basically, Jeroboam's pretty, like, able. He's good at his job. And so Solomon puts him in charge of all the forced labor. And so when Jeroboam is leaving Jerusalem, Ahijah comes to him and he tears his clothes into 12 pieces. And he tells Jeroboam, take 10 pieces, and that thus says the Lord, that I'm going to tear the kingdom apart and I'm going to give you 10 tribes and I'm going to leave one basically for Solomon, for his father's sake, right? Because his father was good, I'll let him keep the kingdom, which isn't really in accordance with the promises that he made previously. It was like, hey, if you keep all my word, I'll pass this line down forever. If you don't, I'm going to take it all away, right? Mm-hmm. Not like I'm going to let you keep a part. But so that's basically what it was. He gets confronted by a prophet who tells him that he's going to make him the king of 10 of the tribes. And he tells him all the reasons and all the things that Solomon has done. Ultimately, Jeroboam flees to Egypt and remains in Egypt until Solomon dies.
I was going to deliver that news, but yeah, Solomon dies. he also sleeps with his ancestors.
Yeah. And we'll get another similar repeated line we'll have for every time someone dies. We'll be reminded that the other stories about these kings are written down in other, books. So this one refers to the Book of the Acts of Solomon, right? Is it supposedly its own book? And to me, that seems like some sort of reference to the thing that the Deuteronomistic history kind of is based on, this idea that there were, these central histories that were being pulled from and edited to tell these stories. And so these were already probably stories people kind of knew. So that's where we're going to go ahead and call it for now. The rest of the First Kings is going to start to kind of tell the stories of the people who come after Solomon and the divided kingdoms and how that all plays out. But we're going to continue that in the next episode.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Bye, y'all.
Bye.